Okay, well, this morning I've got a one-point sermon for you. That doesn't happen very often, does it? But it's an all-age service, and we try and keep the service to an hour. My one point this morning is that the blessings of God are found in the covenant people of God. The blessings of God are found in the covenant people of God. Abraham and Sarai were not the perfect married couple. The household over which they presided was not the perfect household. The story of Abraham from the end of chapter 11 onwards in the Bible tells us that it wasn't the perfect household. And this chapter 16, so do grab a Bible and go to Genesis 16. It's on page 16, very helpfully. Genesis is the easiest book in the Bible to find because it's right at the beginning. Chapter 16. This chapter highlights the dysfunctional nature of Abraham's marriage and household arrangements, just like everyone else's. Yet, he, Sarai, and the household carried the covenant purposes of God. Abraham had been promised by God he would become a great nation, a great name. He'd be the instrument of God's blessing for the whole world. His descendants would be as difficult to count as the number of stars visible from the earth on a clear night with no light pollution. And that was many thousands back then, and it would have been pretty much impossible for Abraham to count them. And chapter 15, verse 6, very important verse. Abraham believed the Lord, and the Lord credited it to him as righteousness. In other words, his faith and trust in God resulted in God's favor upon him. God saw him as righteous. But there's a but. Abraham and Sarai have been living in Canaan for 10 years. And we're told that in chapter 16, verse 3. Sarai had been described way back at the end of chapter 11, when she was fairly young, that she was barren. She was infertile. But when God promised Abraham, and by implication, I think Sarah, lots of descendants, and they entered the land of promise, the land of Canaan, they must have thought that God would soon bless them with at least one child. But they've been waiting 10 years now. And all the while, they were getting older. So they must have felt disappointed, perplexed, frustrated, perhaps even angry with God. What was going on? Lord, why don't we have any children yet? What are you playing at? Sarai said to Abraham, "The Lord has kept me from having children." That's interesting. You see, on the one hand, she recognizes that the Lord is sovereign over her womb, just as he is sovereign over everyone's and everything. But on the other hand, she kind of lost faith that the Lord would fulfill his covenant purposes through her in a loving, in a pure, in a right way. Now, Sarai had a slave or a maidservant. Our old versions of the Bibles that we had in church, the old NIV version, used the word maidservant. It translated the Hebrew as maidservant. Our new NIV versions that we have use the word slave. And the truth is that I think both translations have merit. I think the truth lies somewhere between maidservant and slave. Hagar was a slave in the sense that she was completely under the authority of Sarai and Abraham. But the word slave today tends to imply a situation where someone's cruelly trafficked, necessarily treated like dirt and exploited and abused. And actually that, you know, wasn't necessarily the case by any means. But she was under Sarai's authority. And Sarai said to Abraham, her husband, "I've got this idea. Why don't you sleep with Hagar, my maidservant stroke slave? Perhaps I can build a family through her." Surrogacy arrangement that was not unheard of, actually. There were people in ancient times who did that, just as there are people who do that today. Verse 2 then simply says, Abraham agreed to what Sarai said. And according to verse 3, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant, stroke slave, Hagar, and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with her and she conceived. Does that verse remind you of anything? I think we're meant to see or hear an echo of something earlier in Genesis, something that happened back in chapter 3 in the Garden of Eden. And Eve took some of the fruit of the tree that was forbidden and ate it and gave it to her husband, who also ate of it. The writers of the Bible did not put little details like this in the Bible by accident. No, God inspired them so that every verse is packed with meaning. Just as Adam passively received from Eve, allowed Eve to take the forbidden fruit and received from her the fruit himself, Abraham just went along with Sarai's plan. Now, I don't want you to get me wrong. Most of the time, it's really good for husbands to heed their wives' wisdom. I get into trouble far more often by not listening to Anna than I do by listening to her, particularly when it comes to the psychology of parenting, choice of clothes, getting presents, how much spice to put in the cooking when you're cooking for children, knowing when to call an expert to fix something rather than trying to do it myself, when to fill the car with fuel on a journey, what will work on holidays and what won't, driving safely, when to go in to A&E, and when to just say, you'll get better, you're fine, and knowing generally what's going on in the family. Apart from that, you know, I think I know best. So most things, I think we have to listen to our wives. But there are some times when husbands are called to remind their wives of God's promises. Sometimes we're called to remind our wives of God's goodness, his power. Sometimes husbands are called to dissuade their wives from a course of action that would be damaging to their relationship, to maybe family life, to our relationship with God. For Abraham, this was such a time. What he should have done was, well, first of all, listen, empathize, maybe speak tenderly to Sarah, put his arm around her and say, "Darling, yeah, I know this is really tough. You must feel so terrible that we can't have a baby. It's not your fault. We don't know why God hasn't given us a baby yet. But don't blame yourself. It's in God's hands. I understand why you're suggesting a surrogacy arrangement. But that's likely to cause lots of problems. Let's trust God to keep his promise and bless us in a right way that's good for us all, even if that means a miracle and we can't understand how he's going to do it." That's not what Abraham said. He just went along with it. And what happens? Hagar conceives pretty much straight away. The plans worked. Yippee. Well, no, not really. What's the effect on Hagar, Sarai, and Abraham? It's not great, is it? For the covenant community of God, anything that does not proceed from faith is sin. And sin always causes trouble. First, the effect on Hagar. She becomes proud, arrogant. She actually has, according to this chapter, contempt for her mistress Sarai. She despises her. As a dry old stick who God obviously no longer favors. She is the rising star in the firmament now. She is the one who's going to have power and influence in the household. She will be the mother of the great nation. And Sarai is now full of fury as a woman scorned. Is she happy? Her scheme has worked out. Her plan has come to fruition. That her maidservant stroke slave is pregnant as intended? Not at all. Maybe part of her had hoped Hagar would not get pregnant so that it would be evidence that the fertility problem lay with Abraham rather than with her. But now there was confirmation. Abraham was not firing blanks. The problem was not with him. She was the one who could not fulfill her part. And forgetting whose idea this was in the first place, Sarai approaches Abraham and she's on the warpath. You're responsible for all this. I let you have my slave. Now she knows she's pregnant. She despises me. God knows that's not fair. Again, Abraham fails in his task as husband and head of the household. The household that includes lots of people, including Hagar. His response is basically to try and wash his hands of the whole situation. Well, she's your slave. Do what you like with her. Don't involve me. This is between you and her. I'm off to the pub. He might not have said that, but he might have said something similar. Because there are several ways men have of avoiding their calling to be present in the messy and painful realities of life. And all these escape routes tend to lead to some form of addiction, certainly bad habits, which then slide easily into addiction of some sort. So rather than deal with the pain of life with courage and fortitude, trusting in God, what do men do? Well, men take alcohol, drugs, spend all day gaming on their computers. They gamble, watch pornography, get excessive about the gym and working out. Work excessive hours away from the family. Make their whole world about sport or martial arts or train watching or train spotting or stamp collecting. Whatever it is, men use as an escape route because they're scared and because life is challenging and difficult. And we don't always want that, although we pretend we do.